The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On May 12, 2010, Henry Segerman, Korean stock market specialist and manager of the Korea International Investment Fund, spoke to the Korea Society about how the adoption of two technologies, touchscreens and cloud computing, presents new opportunities for Korean companies as the technology redefines how people use computers around the world.
Thank you all for coming on this rather dreary afternoon. I'll try to make it a little bit more exciting for you. This is our current paradigm in terms of the way people deal with internet information. You got you, the user, that's your mouse, that's your monitor. Maybe you have a flat panel, but it's essentially the same thing. That's your hard drive, and this is the internet where you're getting the information. Within the next 10 years, it seems as if we're going to be switching to a all-new paradigm in terms of our relationship to internet information, where that's a much better looking you, and you're connected to the internet directly with a touch panel, and all of those other steps have been removed. This is called disintermediation, where the intermediary steps have been removed, and I really believe that it's an important new feature and new way of approaching the internet for internet users in the future. Also, as you know, CPUs, central processing units, are used in many functions now. The computational environment is expanding, where you have mini computers on your television set, GPS computers in your car, and so forth and so on. So the overall computing environment is becoming much more fulsome. So to start off our discussion, I'm going to talk to you about mobile telephony, especially smartphones. Smartphones are very big right now, and I want to point out how smartphones essentially represent a growth within growth story between smartphones, touch phones, and multi-touch phones being the ultimate technology in this area. Recently, UBS Securities conducted a survey of cell phone users in the cities where it has branches, pretty scientific survey, and they found that amongst the people who were planning to upgrade their planning to buy a new cell phone, how many of them were going to buy a smartphone, and nearly 60% are going to buy smartphones next time. And that's conducted around the world, that survey. And you can see here, in terms of a forecast, that in the past 2 years, smartphone usage has been rather steady, but what's being forecast is a pretty dramatic growth of smartphone usage, and the percentage amongst all mobile phones getting up to the 40% mark by 2013. As you probably can guess, smartphones cost more money. They have more expensive technology within them, and so the revenue coming from smartphones, although as a percentage of overall mobile phones, they'll still be fractional. By 2012, the revenue coming from smartphones will be over 50% for the mobile phone manufacturers. And if you look at what is selling and what is not selling over the past couple of years, you'll see here that BlackBerry smartphones are number one. And about 2 years ago, we saw a dramatic boost here in the market share of the iPhone. And so iPhones and Nokia are coming in number two in smartphones on a worldwide basis. Three or four days ago, Hewlett-Packard bought Palm, and they're going to blend together their smartphone business, and I would expect them to be a very big player in this area within the next 5 years. Now, moving on in our growth within growth story, let's talk about touch phones, which are those smartphones where you can touch the screen and make something happen. You can see here that as a proportion of overall smartphones, touch phones are going to become more and more important, and the old BlackBerry type of phone is expected in the next several years to be replaced by touch phones, where you can operate the phone with a stylus or your fingers. In particular, Samsung Electronics and LGE, even this year, are using, amongst all of their mobile phones, have already expanded to close to 40% of the overall volume, unit volume, is in touchscreens on their mobile phones. So for the Koreans, this is a very big growth driver. Now, with Samsung and LG, they continue to have non-smartphones, meaning mobile phones that have no CPU and on which you cannot install apps. Those are feature phones is what they're called, because they have various features like MP3 and cameras and so forth and so on, but they do not have a CPU. In the overall touch phones, which include touch phone feature phones, Samsung and LG have been number one worldwide already for the last 2 years. So in terms of having the touch capacity installed on the phone, Samsung and LG are way out ahead of everyone. They do need to do some catch up in terms of smartphone, but in terms of overall touch phones, they're number one and two. In addition to mobile telephones, I want to talk briefly about desktops and laptops having touch capacity. Hewlett-Packard has already introduced something called the TouchSmart, which is a desktop computer, and they also have a laptop version that has touch ability. And J.P. Morgan Securities is forecasting that within the next several years, maybe the next 10 years, 80% of notebook computers and 50% of desktop computers will have touchscreen capacity. It's very small right now, but you can see that they are expecting a big jump this year and going forward as well. In addition to the color isn't very good here, but these are personal use, meaning mobile phones, this part, personal use mobile phones of touch panels. But you can also see touch panels have a significant portion of their business coming from public, household, office, industrial uses as well. So the technology is something that is being adopted in other areas than just mobile phones and computers. In particular, I'll mention netbooks, photo frames, digital cameras, doctor's offices. If you've been to a doctor's office, you can see that they have various panels that they use, and some of them are touch panels, MP3 players, industrial equipment, I was in Korea a few weeks ago, and they were telling me that bus stops will now have touch panels so that you can get your schedule. So this is a very important technology. And as you can see here, this is the mobile phone area, but these other areas represented over here are also will be experiencing growth in the upcoming years. And in terms of money, $6 billion by 2012, touchscreens themselves, meaning just the screen and not the phone, will be selling $6 billion worth of touchscreens per year by 2012. I think that's a rather low estimate, probably be higher. Now moving on to the ultimate growth within growth aspect of this is multi-touch phones, meaning those phones like the iPhone and the more sophisticated touch phones where you can use more than one finger and move the information around on the screen more easily and operate the computing inside the phone in a much more sophisticated manner. You can see here that within the overall touch phone market, a forecast that by 2013 there'll be this growing proportion devoted to multi-touch phones, which are called capacitive. And just to really clarify what we're talking about here, single-touch phones, resistive type, means that you touch it once with a stylus or your finger and you press down on it, and it records the data that one time, that one finger stroke, that one stylus stroke, whereas the multi-touch phone is called capacitive. That means you just touch it lightly, and it registers your touch, and you can use two or three or more fingers and move the information around. Just go to any mobile phone store and try out an iPhone if you don't know what I'm talking about, and you'll see how much more you can do with these capacitive technology. Sorry for these colors; they don't really show up. But in addition to the multi-touch capacitive technology, the Koreans and others are developing a wide variety of capacitive technologies that allow for various things to be done with the touch panel, so that the sophisticated computing can be more comprehensive. And what's quite amazing here is Samsung Electronics, by next year, by the middle of next year essentially, 90% of all of their touch panels, of all of their touch phones, will be capacitive. So it is forecasted that by the end of next year, Samsung will have virtually eliminated all single-touch, old-school touch phones from its product lineup. The manufacturing process of touch phones is fairly complicated, with various levels of glass and coating patterns and shields and different types of synthetic materials that have to go into it. Just to give you, to go back to what we were talking about before, the difference between resistive and capacitive, meaning single touch and multi-touch, is that with the single touch, you press down on the screen and it registers this contact right here. It knows exactly where your finger is. It registers this contact, but you can't do it over here at the same time. You just do it in one spot. And then the screen lifts up, and you can go on to doing other things. With the capacitive or multi-touch model, what is happening instead is that there is a pattern etched onto the synthetic material here, and it's not registering pressure. It's registering the electrostatic impulses from your skin. So You don't need to push at all. You simply tap it. And it can you can tap it twice, three times. You can move two, three, four fingers across it, squeeze, and do all kinds of things. So it's able to absorb far more informational sensory data from the user than the single touch resistive model, giving for many more sophisticated computational possibilities for the user. And the manufacturing process between the two modes is pretty much the same, except for these two gray boxes here, where the synthetic film material is patterned so that it can absorb the electrostatic information from your skin. And the special IC controller, integrated circuit controller, which sends this more sophisticated information to the CPU, so that more things can be done with the mobile phone or touch computer. In addition to the standard touchscreen that we're capacitive touchscreen that we're talking about, there are other touch capacitive touch technologies being developed in Korea, mostly such as Touch Key, which is a capacitive, meaning electrostatic, single-touch key, so simple on-off switches or go-here switches, this type of thing, can be operated by touch keys. It's capacitive, not resistive. You don't have to press, you just tap. And then for usage, we can see here that both of those capacitive technologies go in, especially the touch screen solutions, go in the more sophisticated things like smartphones. And the simpler ones for the on-off switches and so forth go into the digital cameras or other more simple devices. Essentially, both of these technologies can be installed on any of these products. There's no hard and fast rule. It's just multiple applications are possible. And only in Korea, they're in the process of eliminating some of the those multiple layers in the manufacturing process in order to streamline it and simplify it and make it more cost effective, so that with this a direct pattern window, essentially moving the electrostatic sensing patterning from the synthetic film material directly into the glass of the panel. And that's something the Koreans are doing, I think, entirely on their own. Now, the internet, mobile internet, is not just mobile phones and smartphones. But as you know, with the recent release of the iPad and also netbooks and many other types of internet-connected mobile devices, there's going to be astounding growth in the next few years. And for example, the black bars here is just netbooks. I think these numbers are low. If you read the newspapers, you'll see that there's a lot of competition out there for the iPad. So we will probably see quite quite surprising growth in the netbooks. I think it's considered, an iPad is considered a netbook, but by the time they decide, they'll have a brand new category for that, I'm sure. Wireless traffic growth, meaning all of the data, you can see here the expectations going through 2013, especially in North America, Western Europe, and Asia, amazing exponential type of growth in wireless traffic. The wireless traffic is coming from not just these devices that we've been talking about, but also the content itself, which these devices permit, meaning more sophisticated graphics, movies, wireless movies, more music, more complicated PowerPoint presentations. You know, so many things are available wireless, and it's going to add to this wireless traffic growth pattern. And you can see here, we're talking about, on a worldwide basis, a total of 1.2 petabytes of global data traffic per month, and that's 1 quadrillion bytes. So we're talking about quite a lot of data traffic. And 3G, which is mobile data, you can see here that internet is web uses is number one, but we're also seeing a growth forecasted through 2014 in video streaming as well as music streaming. Video, probably fewer units because it's so fat in terms of how much the size of the files that are being viewed relative to music, but still, it's a pretty exciting growth pattern there. And I don't think it's unfair to call the internet, from the mobile point of view, or from any point of view, really, an ecosystem similar to earth, air, or water, where your tools, in this instance, are equipment and telecom service, and these are used to get into your various content platforms to find the raw materials, music, movies, books, various types of databases, all sorts of raw materials that can be mined, essentially, from this ecosystem. Important to note that there's a balance, obviously, between our need as users of the internet and the availability of these content platforms and the accessibility of these raw materials. So, you know, that's why the ecosystem analogy is appropriate. It's not an analogy. It is an ecosystem. And if we expand this from talking about mobile, meaning 3G traffic, to all internet traffic, even up to this year, the equipment manufacturers have been talking about a very, very dramatic growth pattern, which involves fixed line technologies such as video telephony, Skype, MMORPG, massively multiplayer online games, and other types of uses that are exclusive to fixed line, again driving a huge traffic demand on the internet now and going forward. I'm sure that this will continue. You know, it's just going to go perpendicular here. One particular example I'd like to focus on today, because I think it's a commercial application that is quite relevant, is music. And you can see here that over the last 7 years, as we've seen the CD business fall apart. I mean, the music business is really in disarray because the CD business has been falling apart altogether. It's been replaced by this online music model, which has been experiencing steady growth. And that goes back all the way to 2002, with the crossover point being 2003. So this is already something that is a pattern that is well underway, the switch from physical CDs to online music. This is the website for Lala, which is takes the online music paradigm and extends it into from the download technology to streaming technology. And so these the songs and the albums that you can get from Lala are only through something called streaming. And what that means is you cannot download the MP3. First of all, they don't sell CDs. Secondly, you can't even download MP3s from them and store them on your computer. Question?
I'm sorry, you actually can download MP3s from Lala?
Thank you.
You can download MP3s through Lala, but they're shutting down soon because Apple bought them out. So I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. I didn't know that. I knew that they had they focused on streaming, and they focused on streaming. That was their new model, and they've been trying to bring that model into the marketplace. And what happens essentially with streaming is that you correct me if I'm wrong here. You purchase get a subscription to Lala, and then you buy a web album rights to listen to the music on Lala, and if you're connected to the internet, you can listen to these songs anytime you want. But you cannot, if you've only purchased the streaming rights, which are a little bit cheaper, you cannot download the MP3. As he mentioned, and it was mentioned in the invitation today, they've been bought by Apple. Apple is closing them down. And everyone expects that Apple will blend this streaming into their iTunes Music sales department. The iTunes Store is one of the biggest sellers now of online music in the world. And the iTunes program is installed on, of course, every Mac around the world. But it's also installed on hundreds of millions of PCs as well, because it's a very good music player, as well as having access to the iTunes Store, which is a quite a user-friendly and fulsome music library. In Korea, you have all of the music download companies have adopted the streaming model in addition to the download, including Mnet Media, NeoWiz, Bugs, and all of the others that have been doing over the past 7 years MP3 downloads have also adopted the streaming music model. And it's important to note that the film and television industry, which has gone through over the last 20 years some pretty pretty explosive problems in terms of piracy and dealing with piracy, basically has never gone the way of downloads, or has resisted downloads quite a lot. And most of the video on demand available now on a worldwide basis is on the streaming approach, where you never actually have control of the MP3. The hackers are out there trying to figure out how to break that, but they've gone into the streaming model without stopping first in any serious way in the downloading model, as the music business has. And in Korea, I believe that commerce is very important in all this and will drive this type of internet usage, as it, all anything that has grown in the internet has grown because of commerce. But what they've done in Korea is they've taken the deal terms. Now, this slide has to do with the deal between the publisher and the musician. And so since they've had online music downloads for many years, they've taken the deal terms here and adopted them to streaming and changed the pricing. And there's different plans and different clubs you can join and so forth and so on. I'm sure it'll change a lot over the next few years. But they've worked out a series of deal terms so that the artist can participate every time one of his songs, his or her songs, is streamed, and they have lots of big pop stars in Korea. They've worked out these deal terms to make it fair, and I honestly believe that this is a fabulous solution for the problems that have not been solved in the music business having to do with file sharing. You may remember 7 or 8 years ago, Napster got busted because they were doing all this file sharing. And if you significantly reduce the availability of MP3s and make sure that in the streaming format, even if the price point is much lower than it is in the U.S., than for downloads, then you make it a lot easier for artists to, you know, find their revenue in all of this business activity and not feel like they're being ripped off by, you know, file sharing. I think that the streaming solution offers great, because the film and video people have definitely adopted it in Hollywood, or they're getting to adopt it, and they didn't stop with the download approach. Once the music business pursues this aggressively, we're going to see some greater clarification in the overall financial model between artists and publishers in the music business, in my view. So my point here is that streaming music, essentially, the difference between streaming music and downloading music really encapsulates what cloud computing is and can be. That's because in the old model, you kept your CDs at home. You'd buy them at a store and you'd keep them at home. In the download model, you would pop into the internet here, download the MP3, but then you'd keep it here and illegally share it with all your friends and a lot of other people using Napster or some of the other file sharing programs. In the streaming model, what happens is that, you know, you're here, you're in this private space here, and you, anytime you want to listen to the music, you stream it from the internet to your PC or to your listening device, depending upon what type of computing environment you're in at the time, and it saves you all of that disk space. It protects the artist from being ripped off through file sharing, and you still don't have to go to the CD store to buy your CD. So it's an excellent type of solution. And I just wanted to say also that cloud computing, with that definition in mind, I'd like to say cloud computing doesn't really exist. Cloud computing is the internet. The internet is an internet user getting information, files, data, entertainment from the internet. If he gets a download, it's a little more clunky and awkward in terms of the process. But if he's streaming, it's a more streamlined approach. So the internet itself is always a kind of cloud computing. It's just that as these new models are developed and implemented in commerce and in education and in literature, then the cloudiness, if you will increase. So cloud computing isn't really some new thing. That's my only point. It's just an extension of what has been there for many years in terms of the internet. One thing I haven't mentioned is software. It's not just files like music files and movies and books that you can get on a streaming basis, but now software will be held in the web server, so that you can use your software. You don't have to buy a CD-ROM and install the software, or even download the software onto your computer, but simply go to the website and use the software. Google has many softwares that you can use through the Google website, and after all those years of paying $350 for Microsoft Office every time it was upgraded, next week Microsoft Office 2010 is coming out, and it's going to be free and it's going to be online. So that just proves to you that Microsoft is thinking about these things, and if they're thinking about it, it's a happening thing. And just to continue our discussion of how this thing works, in the cloud computing model, this is the website that allows the user access to the cloud platform. And these are the servers where all of the music files and all of the software and all the video files are kept. And instead of having to get, you know, a 500 gigabyte hard drive for your desktop, now all of those files that you've been keeping and wondering whether you need to keep them or should delete them, many of them will be accessible through web servers held elsewhere. And what that means is that millions and millions of people can use these files instead of having, you know, one user to one file relationship. You'll have millions and millions of users using all of these files and all of this software. And I think what's really exciting about that is that right now, I mean, just think of your world. You're just one person, and how much data do you consume every day? You know, quite a lot. You listen to these songs, you watch these TV shows, you read these books, you go to these online newspapers. How many of them do you download onto your computer? How much software do you download onto your computer? The more cloudy the internet becomes, the better, because what it means is that the user will have access to more and more things. Sure, there'll be billing. You'll have to pay for it. But, you know, the more that this process becomes central to how we deal with the internet, the more data you will have access to, and the easier, because you will no longer need to save as much stuff on your hard drive as you do now. And then we all know that when we go to Yahoo Shopping or Priceline, you know, you can be connected on one website to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, or from Priceline you can be connected to American Airlines and Delta Airlines on the same page. So, you know, an important aspect of cloud computing is that multiple computers, multiple users are interacting, you know, with multiple cloud sites, so that the maximum amount of interactive information can be available to you, the user. Now, in the United States, if any of you have Fios, Fios is ADSL, so you can see here that we're down here right now. Fios is the fastest. It's about, 2 megabytes per second. This is old DSL. It's down below 1. It's like down here. So if you have an old DSL, I mean, you know, dial-up is down here. Some people in the U.S. still have dial-up, and old DSL is around here. And this is, you know, fast ISDN. And this is Fios, which is kind of the American version, the fastest American retail available bandwidth in terms of network equipment. And the Koreans are already working on 1,000 megabytes per second. This is... this technology here, you know, is mostly for businesses, but it's, you know, it's already like 500 times, well, 300 or 400 times faster than the fastest retail available bandwidth in the United States. So the Koreans are pursuing this, as they have pursued all broadband, very, very aggressively with high expectations. And in the mobile area as well, with the 3G networks, you know, they are building out with their equipment the capacity to handle millions and millions of multi-touch smartphones, as well as iBooks. And, of course, Samsung is going to have its iPad competition, and LG will have its iPad competition. So it's going to be a pretty exciting time for those companies. And the network equipment companies have already seen annualized growth of 22% over the last 5 years. I think that this number, if you look at 2010 through 2015, sales of network equipment will also skyrocket in Korea. And the companies that are doing this are also aggressively getting into exporting this equipment. So it's going to be a pretty exciting time for the Korean data equipment companies in the next 5 years. And, you know, I just wanted to, you know, mention to you that these are some of the companies that we own that are doing things in the areas that I've been talking about today. You know, I do think that if you add up what's going on in touch screens with the various types of touch screens and the more sophisticated models that are able to really connect you to the internet in a fulsome kind of way, and with some of the new business models emerging from cloud computing and the types of ready access to the internet that cloud computing permits in Korea and around the world, that it's going to be a very exciting time over the next 5 or 10 years in terms of the way we interact with the internet. And obviously, you know, we've mentioned Samsung Electronics, LG Electronics. These are companies that devote a fraction of their efforts to smartphones, and you can buy them on European stock markets fairly easily. But if you're a little more adventuresome and can register in Korea, these are some of the companies that we own that are listed on the Korean stock market, and these are the Bloomberg consensus earnings growth for next year. And they're all in the we make sure they're all in the seriously in the double digits, and some of them are in the triple digits in terms of next year's earnings growth because they're in these very exciting new technological areas. I have a list here if you want to pick up a copy if you're interested. That's the end of my presentation, and I hope you learned a little bit. There won't be a test, but I will answer questions, and I'm eager to hear people correct me, too, if I misspoke myself on some, especially some of the American companies.
Please wait for the microphone as well. Thank you.
First, very good presentation.
Thank you.
China, as you know, has gotten a little expensive, so China's outsourcing to Thailand, Vietnam, et cetera. I didn't know if Korea was doing that because Korea's gotten a little more expensive than it used to be. Are they outsourcing some of their manufacturing to other Southeast Asian countries?
If you buy a Samsung television, it's probably made in Malaysia or Indonesia or something, so the answer to that is yes. Korea has a number of technologies like touchscreen where they really have to, it's very, very complicated and expensive and value-added, and for the time being, they're doing it in Korea. But in terms of assembly and some of the, you know, mid-level parts, they're absolutely in Southeast Asia and to some degree in Latin America. So the answer to your question is yes. But that's not to say that they're not in China or have abandoned China. The unit labor cost in China is, relative to Korea, very attractive. And they will remain in Korea as well as going into these markets.
Do you have a sense as to what percentage of components in the iPad and in the iPhone are manufactured by Korean manufacturers, say flash memory chips or controller chips or whatever?
You know, not a lot. I mean, we didn't talk about it today, but in terms of touch computing, the iPhone is way out ahead, obviously. The iPad is expected to make a serious dent in this brand new netbook area, if you want to call it that. The Koreans are not supplying the screens to iPad. They're made by an in-house type company called Balda. And interestingly, the iPad and the iPhone do not use light-emitting diodes, OLED technology. They use old-fashioned LCD technology. So with the iPhone, you still have the backlight feature in the screen. So it's a little bit antiquated compared to what Samsung Electronics is doing, and even Nokia is beginning to adopt the OLED technology. Flash, yes, they are selling them flash. IC, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they're selling them IC, but there's not a whole lot of business that the Koreans do with Apple for the iPhone per se. When you talk about Apple monitors, it's a different story. They buy a lot of Apple, a lot of Korean Samsung display, and LG sell a lot of display panels to Apple for the desktop and laptop.
Hi. I actually manage a portfolio of Japanese clients and advise them on political risk, and they're a bit more sort of old economy companies than what you're talking about, and I'm not an expert on Japanese technology at all. But there's a lot of time spent bemoaning, you know, the lack of innovation in Japan, and I don't think anyone would argue with the fact that, you know, the Koreans are really eating the Japanese lunch in the broader global marketplace right now. And I just wondered if you could speak at all to, you know, what it might be structurally or about, you know, Korean innovation in the last 10 or 15 years that has really, you know, produced this, because you, it's not just the technology that you're talking about. It's not just that every single appliance that you buy in the United States or Japan now is made in Korea. I mean, there's a soft power component to this as well. And I just wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, it's funny because, of course, there's this tortured history between Korea and Japan going back for the entire past century with the colonization and the comfort women and all of that. But after the war, the Japanese rebuilt themselves by adopting the Zaibatsu model, which are these unwieldy, large, family-run conglomerates. And 15, 20 years later, the Koreans developed the Jebo model, which is really a kind of a spitting image of the Zaibatsu model. And right down the manufacturing line, the Koreans went after the jugular, basically, of the Japanese, steel, shipbuilding, memory chips, picture tubes. Korea now has the top six shipbuilders in the world. It has the number two steel company after Arcelor. So the Japanese are no longer up there in the top two. And picture tubes also, including LCDs. The Koreans have replaced the Japanese, who were running the show 10 years ago. And in all of these technologies, the Koreans have replaced the Japanese. There's certain things where the Japanese have some advantages, and the Koreans are happy to buy from the Japanese when particular highly sophisticated ICs or, you know, various little things are needed. And there's a healthy... there's a healthy exchange between Korea and Japan all along in terms of, you know, NEC, you know, Korean picture tubes going into Panasonic assembled TVs, and, you know, and vice versa. I can't cite the exact examples, but they do go back and forth. And I just think that the Japanese model kind of got, you know, clogged up by very, very slow, tradition-bound management, while the Korean model was more, although family-dominated and, you know, filled with problems, was more aggressive and more flexible in pursuing these industries. Good question. That's a nice, slow pitch. Why are the Koreans better than the Japanese?
Hello, my name is Joseph, and I'm from Shinhan Investment. Thank you for your wonderful presentation. I have a quick question. You mentioned about the Samsung and LG, and this particular their smartphone area. They're a little bit struggling these days. If you look at the past and what year, hit by all these Apple iPhones and RAM smartphones. These days, I heard that Motorola and Nokia are trying to come back with smartphones. Do you see this Motorola and Nokia as a risk to and the Samsung and LG might be threatened by these the players again?
Well, in the middle of 2006, Samsung and LG were considerably behind Motorola in feature phones, meaning the non-smartphones, and with a very aggressive marketing campaign and production campaign, both Samsung and LG reduced Motorola's, in a period of about 15 months, reduced Motorola's market share in feature phones from 30% to 10%, something like that, and basically replaced Motorola with a combined total close to 30%. So I have no doubt that Samsung and LG can beat out Motorola and Nokia. And from all evidence, the Motorola and Nokia multi-touch phones are not the iPhone killer. Those two companies, as well as Samsung and LG, you know, still have this insurmountable phone foe in the multi-touch phone, which is the iPhone. A lot of it, currently, in terms of the market impact, the draw for the iPhone is the apps and the way that the touchscreen functions, which is much more is just better than the Europeans have come up with and the North Americans have come up with so far. So I'm very confident that they'll be able to best out Nokia and Motorola in multi-touch smartphones. But iPhone is another matter. I'm not sure. It's been a very very strong contender.
Hi, I'm Dick Rades. What have the Koreans been doing to develop the intellectual capital that goes into all of this progress? You keep reading about Google and Microsoft opening R&D centers in China and to access that intellectual capital, but you don't read anything about Korea, and I'm wondering, you know, are we missing a bet by not trying to access this human capital that's there as well?
Well, I have to disagree with you on that. If you read Steve Roach, who's the Asia economist for Morgan Stanley, 3 days ago wrote a piece talking about Korea as one of the top R&D spenders worldwide, especially in terms of its per capita GDP. It spends hugely on R&D. And it's not just the individual companies like these where they devote a great deal of their efforts to R&D to try to come up with new technologies that will, you know, revolutionize whatever they're doing now. But the government has special tanks like the CAIST, the Korea, what is it, CAIST, K-I-I-S-T, CAIST, that, you know, foster this type of thing, plus tax credits and all kinds of incentives for these small tech companies to push heavily into R&D. So I think R&D is very big in Korea. And just visit Samsung Electronics, and it's just frightening the amount of ideas that they're generating all the time. And they just have programs, and, you know, they're divesting themselves of their hierarchical structure so that new ideas will, you know, work their way into the system more easily than they have in the past. I think they're all approaching this very, very aggressively.
Okay, but are American companies able to access the same human capital? I mean, I haven't read about Google setting up an R&D facility in Seoul to access what's going on there, or Microsoft, or...
You know, I think that what Microsoft and Google are doing in India and China is very interesting, and you know, it's part of the world is flat, and a very important part of how we will see the rest of this century, and how different nations will exchange ideas, and how businesses will develop. I think that those companies are doing great things. Can you match what they're doing in India and China in Korea? Probably not. I think what they're doing in India and China is based on the absence of Samsung Electronics in those countries. You don't have companies which are such a magnet for brilliant people like Samsung Electronics, and like, you know, what you can do in the tech sector where there's plenty of capital available. The unit labor cost, obviously, in Korea is not quite as appetizing for these corporations. I mean, I think that what they're doing is great, but on a certain level, it's opportunistic because they're looking for, you know, China graduates a million engineers every year. And these are people that can be hired for $20,000 a year. You know, it's just how could American corporations not, you know, rush after that just on the hopes that if they hired 10 people, they'd find one who was a genius? They probably would. And it would be cost effective. I can't even, there's a hand in the back, see?
This may reflect my own ignorance, but it seems to me that not that long ago when people spoke about East Asia and Southeast Asia, there were countries other than Korea that seemed to be regarded as sort of the, you know, the leaders and the tigers and all this stuff. And while Korea may have been part of that conversation, I'm not sure it was regarded as a leader in that category. Korea now seems to be in almost, you know, at a different level than many of those other countries. And I'm curious as to what is it that's happened in the last decade or so that seems to have set apart Korean companies from many other companies, even in Asia. And as you pointed out, you know, whether one looks at the kind of old industries like auto or steel or shipping, there's a remarkable Korean story to be told. And if one looks at the high tech sector, again, there's a remarkable Korean story to be told. And apparently in Asia, even on the entertainment side, there is a, you know, a very strong Korean story to be told. So what happened? I mean, it's good, but what happened?
I don't know if Korea was excluded from the Asian tigers at any point, but maybe it has jumped out ahead more recently, certainly in the entertainment with the Korean Wave and Rain, and all of these Japanese housewives are going crazy about Korean pop stars. In terms of industry and technology, they've just been growing, and I think there's been a kind of rebranding in Korea that has... Maybe it's affected perceptions here in North America and in Western Europe, which is 15 years ago, Hyundai was a tin can car. Samsung was a cheap plastic television set that you bought for $69. And today, you know, Hyundais are up there with Infiniti. And Samsung and LG components are, you know, are fabulous. And so it's, you know, there's been, and that was a deliberate effort on the part of Korean corporates to create this brand awareness around the world and to figure out what message they wanted to give to customers in Western Europe and North America. Great example is the 10-year powertrain warranty from Hyundai. You know, American cars just have this horrible reputation of planned obsolescence. They fall apart after 5 years. You know, they're burning oil and, you know, falling apart and veering off the freeway. You know, it's just a bad story. But the Koreans, you know, they came out with these, you know, higher quality cars than ever before. And on top of that, they give you this 10-year powertrain warranty. This was about 3 or 4 years ago. And at that point, you know, Hyundai jumped from, I don't know, 1% to 4% of the U.S. market or something like that. They came up with something that really, you know, really got to people. So that was, you know, part of this rebranding. And, you know, that may answer your question. Are you not done?
As you mentioned, like the Samsung campaign, you know, it was one day you were like, okay, where's Samsung? And suddenly it was everywhere you looked. There was an ad for Samsung, you know, on bus stops, magazines, TV, everywhere. And it was a transformational ad campaign, I think, brilliantly done. But ultimately, you have to back up image with substance. And, you know, my guess is a company like Hyundai would probably go bankrupt if it couldn't actually support, if it wasn't actually producing cars that didn't require enormous repair during that 10-year window. So it seems to me, I think the branding component is a critical component, and it's a primary driver of what's happened, but there seems to be something a lot deeper and richer that has happened. And, you know, maybe it's just the world didn't, obviously it is, the world didn't necessarily pay enough attention, but it just, it's very interesting to me to think about, you know, what has happened in the last 10 or 20 years versus what happened in the previous, in the 10 or 20 years preceding that.
I agree with you.
What's the status in Korea of venture capital, Asian angel investing, corporations and pension funds putting funds into smaller companies, newer companies? Is that going on at all or a lot?
Sure. There are VC companies operating in Korea. MBK Partners, which is a startup started up by Michael Kim, who was with the Carlyle Group. Has been involved in quite a lot of VC activity. And in Korea, you have 1,600 listed companies, 600 on the 700 on the Korea Stock Exchange, and 900 or so on the secondary market, the KOSDAQ. And what that means is that there's... and it's very liquid. Both markets are very liquid. It means that there's a very healthy exit IPO for new VC companies. So I think it's definitely there are opportunities there. Of course, you know, there's a lot of flim-flam men out there who are, you know, coming up with these wacky ideas. And during the dot-com bubble, there were fortunes lost on VC ventures, but that's the risk you take, and it's not unlike the Wild West in Silicon Valley, where you have to be very, very investigate before you invest.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.